I try to use open-ended questions. I try not to do any yes or no answers. What drives you? What motivates you? And just leave the candidate to kind of tell that story.
Welcome to another episode of Higher Learning. I am your host, Oz Rashid. This is the show where we have conversations with founders, executives, people disrupting their industries about what they see differently when it comes to identifying unique top talent. If this is your first episode, thank you so much for joining. Glad you could be here. If you are a longtime listener, we appreciate all the support. All of you, please subscribe on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you find podcasts, and please give us a high rating. So today I am joined by a longtime friend and a very, very special guest. I'm joined by Jose Ciade, formerly of LPL Financial, where he was an SVP of product management, but now moved into the entrepreneurial space. He's co-founder of not one, but two companies, Built by Prime and Tech Wisp AI. Jose, how you doing?
Stoked to be here, Oz. Great to see you again. Great to talk again. And happy to be sharing some of the history, some of the learnings, and anything that can help out either somebody on the product side or somebody starting up a new company.
Brother, you are a wealth of information, and the whole product roadmap and go-to-market has been my life for the last couple of years, so I'm excited to pick your brain on some of these things. But I want to start here because now that you're on the startup and founder side, I want to talk about that because you took on not just one journey, but two journeys there. But I want to go back quickly before we go forward. Let's talk about the time at LPL Financial, because working at a product management organization of that size, I have to imagine is very different than what you are doing now.
Absolutely.
So tell us a little bit about the role, the scope of the role, and what you did for LPL.
Sure. So LPL Financial started there 2021. They needed somebody with experience having a product portfolio, different areas of the business. And I started out my product management journey in Yahoo, right? Back in the day, 2006, and with a very diverse product portfolio, online product services. And LPL Financial, just for those of your listeners who don't know, has a network of about 20,000 financial advisors all throughout the U.S.
I'm a customer.
There you go. And a lot of people don't even know that they're customers of LPL Financials because these are independent financial advisors, right? These are folks who don't belong to the UBSs or the Merrill Lynches of the world and go out and have their own business, but they do have this network of LPL that helps them do their day-to-day job, right? These folks are small business owners who don't know a ton about marketing or internet marketing or cybersecurity or other things to run their business, but they need these kinds of services. So LPL founded this division called Business Services, and what that division's whole being is, or reason for being, is that they help these small business owners, these financial advisors, run their business and make their business flourish. So two of those products within that division, one of them being Admin Solutions, provides virtual admin services. We set you up with an admin who helped you not just set up your calendar or manage your calendar, also helps you with more complex things like annuity order entries and things that are very specific to financial advisors. So we trained these folks, we got them up to speed, and then provided these services to the advisors. On the other side of the plate, cybersecurity, right? Digital Office, that's the other product that I ran. This one was all about cybersecurity, online storage, things that are very digital in nature, that a financial advisor really didn't have the experience or knowledge in that area to know what it is that they needed to keep their business running. So come in, have to get these two products up to par, need to get them very well staffed, need to make them profitable. These products weren't profitable, weren't growing. So had to come in, had to look at the business from the financial side, from the product side, make sure you have product market fit, make sure that these products make sense for these financial advisors. So that's what LPL Financial, my tenure there, was all about.
Yeah, so what I'm interested in, and I'm sure you listen to Lenny's podcast once in a while like I do, I listen to it pretty religiously. And one of the themes that he brings up in there a lot of the times is that as a product management organization, a lot of times in some organizations, the relationship with development or the relationship with sales isn't always the strongest. I'm just interested in that dynamic and what it was like at LPL. And what do you think are kind of the keys to fostering
a healthy dynamic there between those very interconnected functions within an organization.
Sure. And you being a big football guy, this is where that comes in, right? You're the midfielder, right? Without a solid midfield, team's not going to go anywhere, right? So the development guys, you can think of it as the goalkeeper, cybersecurity, keeping things safe, those defenses in the back, you know, making sure that the code's safe, that everything's well built, that everything is working well, right? And then the sales guys are your forwards. They need to make the goals, they need to make the sales, they need to make everything work on the financial side. So you're kind of in the middle and you're looking out to see, hey, I may need to compensate here, compensate there, change the product, change the requirements. Hey, the market's changed, right? Is anybody taking in this feedback into the product development, into the features, into the pricing, into these different things to make sure that you're compensating for these different changes in the environment or in your own company? The strategy for the company changes. And somebody's got to make sure that whatever the customer or the audience needs, it is being provided by the company. Because if it isn't, then you may lose out on that customer or in a whole segment in the market.
I really love that analogy. Taking it a step further, we're going to say that maybe Liverpool has the greatest young product management organization in world football. Maybe you guys were the Real Madrid over at LPL. I know you're very accomplished out there. I absolutely love that analogy. That is amazing. Thinking of your forwards as sales, thinking of cybersecurity as your goal. I really love that. Really great analogy. Thank you for breaking it down that way. And yes, in a language that I understand and love. So that made a lot of sense for me. So let's talk about it this way. I find that not everybody has a traditional path into product management. In fact, it seems to me to be a job that a lot of people, like, either they started in coding and maybe went that route, or maybe they were in a more functional role, but they wanted to be more closer to the technology. But I traditionally don't find that a lot of people like go to school for product management, start in product management and work their way up into a long product management. I'm sure it happens. I know it happens, but it seems few and far between. I'm interested in your journey. How did you get into product management?
Well, to me, it was, I studied industrial engineering in college and I actually went to a factory. I actually worked in a factory in operations, managing 500 people in that factory. And to a point, I went, did my master's in business administration. And when I came out of the master's, I was looking for an opportunity to help me get into technology, right? And like I said, Yahoo here, Yahoo Latin America, which is based here in Miami, where I think you and I are based. Yeah.
This is Fort Lauderdale, but we consider Miami proper.
There you go. So it's the Miami-Dade, Broward/Broward County. Yahoo Latin America was based here, right? Coral Gables. And they were looking for somebody who could help not just Yahoo Latin America, but all of the emerging markets, make it more operation, make it more standardized. Because as you can imagine, we had Southeast Asia, we had Latin America, Eastern Europe, a lot of up and coming regions and countries that had come up as they could, right? With the resources that they could. You know, Yahoo as an organization was very strong in the US, very strong in Europe, very strong in some countries in Asia. But the smaller markets were very nimble, were very entrepreneurial, and had come up and grown, each one with their own processes, each one with their own direction. So it was very hard for my boss, who I give the call out to for hiring me. He needed somebody to help make sense of what was happening with all these countries. And my first role was in product operations, making sure that there was a roadmap. There was no roadmap for Yahoo emerging markets before I came in. So first thing I had to do was make sure that all of these different markets had a roadmap, were sticking to that roadmap, and had the resources necessary to execute that role. And then what started happening was there were some movements in Latin America. Some people left, some people got reorganized, and my boss started telling me, hey, Jose, I know you're not a product guy, not a traditional product manager, but I've got this project called Yahoo Answers. And there's nobody to lead it. I just had to let somebody in LATAM go. You got to take it over. I said, yeah, I'll take it. That's fine. 2 weeks later, hey, we've got this new front page redesign. I don't have anybody to lead it. Can you take it? I said, yeah, I'll step up to the plate. That's fine. Same thing for Mail, Messenger. Like I started taking on more and more responsibilities on the product side, started learning a lot. And you got to remember, this is 2006. The Agile Product Manifesto had just come out in 2001, which is the starting point for digital product management, for modern product management. So this is just 5 years later. You didn't have courses. You didn't have YouTube. You couldn't go and just find something to help you improve. So you got to learn on the job and start asking people with some experience, trying to pick things up along the way and bringing in your own experience in operations and structuring and process. So I started picking up, and before I knew it, I had 75-80% of all the product portfolio in LATAM. And my boss calls me in one day and says, you know what? I think you have to find somebody to replace you on product ops because you need to keep this as your day job. You've got too many responsibilities on the product side in LATAM to keep your product operations responsibilities.
I love that.
So
what a journey going from it, and you've built a distinguished career in this space now, and now you're taking it to the startup world. Well, I want to talk about them more because I want to hear about these two, but there's a couple other things I want to jump into. If I'm thinking about, because I'm fascinated by this stuff, and maybe we're just going to nerd out on SaaS stuff right now, but my podcast, we're going to run with it. We're going to do it the way we think is best.
Sounds good.
I think there's a Mount Rushmore of startup books that everybody recommends, right? We got High Output Management. We've got Crossing the Chasm. We got Zero to One. Okay. And you and I have both read a book called The Lean Startup, and I believe it's by Eric Ries. And so the whole thesis of this book is really around taking your minimum viable product or just getting your product out the door and not being like, one of the things I think it says in the book is if you're not embarrassed about your product, then you haven't gone fast enough. And then iterating based on feedback you get from putting it in people's hands and having them tell you and going from there. I'm interested now, obviously very different than what you encountered at LPL, where I think it probably had to be different, although you could probably run some experiments and things that were similar in nature. But I'm just interested, why do you prescribe this methodology? Why do you think that this is the way forward?
So first off, you're absolutely right. You're trying to find product market fit, which is kind of the apex of where you want to be with the product.
Well, let's
right?
stop there real quick, because I think a lot of people have heard that term. Let's define it real quick. So, and then listen, I've heard different definitions for it, but go ahead and give me your definition of product market.
The best one that I can tell you is it's the right product for the right crowd at the right time. You can get technical, you can say a whole bunch of different things, but if a group of folks during a specific period of time like your product, recommend it, and your product grows from those folks, then you probably have product market fit.
Well, here's why it's important, why it's the holy grail. Because when you're a startup, you are working with a finite amount of money, especially initially. You've got to make things work with rubber band and bubble gum and things like that to get it off the ground. And if you don't find product market fit, then you don't have a company. You just can't exist, right? Because you're not making enough money. You're not getting the velocity you ultimately need. Forget being a unicorn, just to make sure you can pay your bills over a long enough timeline, have investment, whatever it may look like. So that's why that is something that you hear a lot. A lot of people are like, great, right market, right product, right timing. Yeah, but the problem is you're dead if you don't have it. So that it's kind of the difference between life or death. It's like saying product market fit is akin to breathing, because if you don't have that, then you don't got a company at the end of the day, right?
Yeah, exactly. And look, you got to grow the business. You got to have money to spend, right, on marketing or on whatever you need. But if you don't have that engine, if you don't have that engine powering your business, then you don't have a business.
No, the problem is you can make money in the interim, but the problem is if you don't have product market fit on a long enough timeline, it's just not going to work. You're going to be wasting money. You're going to be putting money into the wrong places. It's hard enough as it is. You absolutely have to have that velocity going forward to have a chance to be one of these 2-3% companies that actually make it and become something, you know, of note. So
absolutely.
Okay, so you were so sorry. We're talking about getting the product out and iterating it. So I interjected there real quickly.
No, that's fine. That's fine. So yes, you got to find that product market fit. And in order to do that, right, there used to be, still used in a lot of ways, but waterfall, right, in terms of project management. So you put together a product, you say, this is everything, this is 100% of what I need to do to launch this product. And then you start with some description of what you need to do. And then you break it up into parts, you build it out, and at the end you deliver. That's the way it kind of used to be. And then you have more agile development, which is something that the book also prescribes a lot, which is, hey, why don't you just iterate? Why don't you start with something very small and then iterate to improve that small thing into a more complete product? And that's what you were talking about, which is an MVP, which is a minimal viable product. And that is, to your point, something you may be embarrassed, it may have bugs, it may not be perfect, but you get it out to the customer as soon as you possibly can to validate the assumptions that you have, right? So if you're putting together a website and it's to improve somebody's image, then you put together the most basic thing about a website, which is I take a picture of you, you send it in, somebody processes it, gets it back to you, and that's it, right? It's very minimal functionality, but it solves a problem for the customer, right? It solves something that the customer's pains are in a very streamlined way to the customer, and then gets it back to the customer, right? Without any bells and whistles, without looking nice, without looking, it's the most basic thing you can, but it gets something done, right? That's the minimum viable product. And then the book tells you, you got to be lean about it, right? You got to, all your processes, your operation, everything else that you're doing, if you can bring that down to the minimum amount of changes that need to be done to that product before getting it back out for more feedback, then you do that, right? And you do something that's called a build, measure, learn cycle, right? So that build, measure, learn cycle, as you keep going down your development process, that can really help you if you're measuring the right things, right? Because sometimes we go down these rabbit holes of saying, hey, time spent, this was a big one back in my day. You need to improve time spent on a page. Well, you can do that by just putting games on it, right? And having people just playing games on it doesn't mean you're selling more, doesn't mean that people are more engaged. They're just spending more time on that page. You could load the page slower and they would spend more time on it, right? But if you really want to measure whether somebody is happy with that page, if they're happy with your product, right? You do something like NPS, Net Promoter Score, right? Where somehow you get some feedback, be that some feedback forms or be it a scoring mechanism or something else, you bring bad feedback that tells you, hey, your customer is happy with the service they're being provided, with the product that they're interacting with. And again, you measure that over time and your build, measure, learn cycle, you're building a small amount, you're measuring the right variables, and you're learning not just from the variables, but you're learning from feedback from the customer. You're learning from the data, right? Is the page loading quickly? Is the customer satisfied? Did you complete the whole process? Back in my Millicom days, we haven't talked about Millicom.
We're going to get there. Don't worry about that.
Yeah, which is a telecom that I used to work for. A lot of our processes did not end at 100%. Right? An API would fail somewhere and they couldn't give us any feedback about it because they just got bumped off. You churned, right? You had a customer churn and you didn't know about it because you weren't getting the feedback. So how do you know? And it was by tracking that API from beginning to end, making sure that everything was loaded. So again, the book, as we've said, you get an MVP, you get it out there. You learn from it, you iterate in the leanest way possible, you run your business the leanest way possible, and then you can hopefully attain something that has that engine of growth that'll get you to the point that we were talking about and attaining that product market fit, which we were talking about, where if you get that and you manage your company well, then probably you're going to have a winner on your hands.
Yeah. So Jose, one of the things that I don't think I fully understood until I got into this space, and some people might be listening and not fully understand, is like, we live in a world where the customer is expecting high quality right from the beginning. Like, they have a certain experience in mind. But what we're really saying is, we know we're bringing something that's not quality, high grade out there. You find that the customers seem to be a lot more forgiving or a lot more understanding of that than you might typically think when you're paying for something, or maybe they're not paying, but you know what I mean by that, right? I was always like, first impression, I only get a chance to make one good first impression. I want it to be perfect. But that's actually death in the software space, and that customers actually are understanding that you're trying to build something and they actually enjoy maybe riding shotgun with you on that. Any other more clarity there? Anything you'd say there?
I think you have to be very mindful of the situation you're in, because in something like a Yahoo of the world, and I attended a very interesting summit inside of Netflix where they would show us all the different algorithms that they use and all the different pages that they would use simultaneously to learn about customers, paying customers. But you've probably seen 5 or 6 different types of presentations for your Netflix homepage, right? And everybody who's listening to this will likely have gone through it. Sometimes you don't notice that things are changing. If you're in that situation, that's great. You're learning, you're improving, and the customer doesn't notice. So that's a good one, right? Somebody's paying you for your service and it's more of a service. And we had this during LPL. They were paying us good money for us to have either on the cybersecurity side or on the admin side. Well, we couldn't be as radical as Netflix is. You would see some of those things on Netflix where it's can't even, I don't even know if it's Netflix or Hulu, right? Because they change things so greatly, I couldn't tell. Here, you had to be LPL admin solutions. You can test some things. You can tell the advisor, hey, I'm going to test some new things out. Do you want to be a part of it? Do you want to take that risk? Do you want to be an early adopter of my new product? And most of the times, this is a highly competitive field, right? Financial advisors, you've got tons of them, 120,000, 130,000 of them, independent ones in the US. So they want whatever edge you can give them. They'd say, yeah, I'll sign up for it. If these are folks who were risk averse and didn't want anything to change, they would say, hey, I don't want it. I don't want to opt in. So I think depending on the situation you're in, knowing your customer, right, is important in knowing what kind of decisions and what kind of tests you're going to do on your product. And if it's an industry that goes slowly, financial services, then you try to push the envelope as much as you possibly can without not fitting in into the industry, not fitting in with the customer. If it's the internet, sorry, buddy, you got to move fast, right? And you got to iterate and you got to take some risks, calculated risks, but risks nonetheless, to ensure that your product can keep up with the competition, right? Facebook is the perfect example of that, right? Facebook started out as hot or not, and it was just one functionality. And then it garnered and it kind of snowballed into what we now know is a social network. But it started out really small and it iterated into this behemoth that
I mean, I would say,
and there's a ton of different examples of
all these different things. And the same thing with Amazon. Amazon started as a bookstore, right? Online bookstore before becoming what they are too. So you got to start all of the big companies that you've heard of ran a lean startup methodology up front to prove out an idea before becoming the behemoths, the monoliths that they are. Quickly, I want to ask you, when I think about product marketing, a lot of times I used to think of the intersection between marketing and technology, right? But you have a very operational background and you say that's very key to your success. And I think that's a very rudimentary way to look at it, is that cross-section of marketing and technology. But explain to me why being operational in this space you think has been successful for you in your career and why you'd recommend it.
Because of the fact that you just mentioned that if I tell my daughters, hey, go study to be a product manager, you probably can't. I just checked in prep for our conversation. There is no product management degree that you can get. You can get a business degree. And there's a bunch of universities who do this. There's a business degree with a product design minor or a product management certificate or something like that. You can't go and study to be a product manager in college, right? You can study after the fact to be in this, but you bring something different every time, especially with folks who start out in the odds like I did. They all brought something to the table, right? They were project managers. They were coders. They were software manager, there was something, right? From my perspective, what I brought to the table was understanding and process. So I was the best one that you could find in all of Yahoo probably, who could take a process, break it down to the minimum of that process and improve. Continuous improvement in any industrial engineer's hard coding, continuous improvement has to be there, right? You study that, you perfect that. And same with the lean startup. It tells you have to have continuous improvement to be successful in product management, right? You have to have a feedback cycle for you to be successful. So there's a lot of things that modern product managers leverage from industrial and systems engineering that I had already perfected, had already had experience with. Again, process was one. System dynamics in terms of how you understood organizational systems, road mapping, project management, which you also have, it's all there. So there were a lot of basis for core product management that I had studied back in college and that I could put to good use. And I think that helped me, and not to have the MBA, which gives you all the financial side of things. You take a little bit of marketing, you take a little bit of other things that I didn't take in a core engineering degree. But all those things together, I think, put together a very compelling case to say, hey, this guy can leverage product management to have a successful career and to have products that can be successful.
Finding the right talent for your team doesn't have to be a struggle. Meet Aon Hire, the world's first hiring experience management platform designed to transform the way you hire. Powered by AI, Aon Hire takes the hassle out of every step in the process. From smart resume analysis to customized interview questions, it saves you time, money, and effort. Plus, with real-time insights from every interview, you can quickly identify top candidates, reduce turnover, and stay on budget. And forget about note-taking. Aon Hire takes care of that for you. Ready to revolutionize your hiring process? Visit aonhire.com and get started today.
That's really good advice for anybody that's thinking about getting into this space, how you can stand out in this space. I would make the case that being operational in any role, whether it be a human resources, talent acquisition, technology, product marketing, like being able to kind of execute is a key, and being able to operationalize things and take things from concept into actual tasks and activities and outputs. I think that's germane to every function that's in. So I love that. Great explanation. Here's what we're going to do. We're going to jump a little bit into the hiring stuff because I want to pick your brain on this a little bit. And then we're going to talk about your startups. I want to ask this though. We worked together. We first met, I think, when you were at Tigo Millicom. Now, for people that don't know, Tigo Millicom is one of the biggest, if not the biggest, telecom provider in Latin America. And we were lucky enough to kind of own all hiring for them back at the time when you used to work there. Now, remind me, did we just work with you as a hiring manager or did we identify you as a candidate?
I think both. I think your team kind of led the whole hiring while I was getting hired. And then afterwards, I partnered with a few members of your team to go out and hire.
I love that.
For my role.
So here's what we got to do. We got to pat ourselves on the back a little bit here. If you've been listening to Jose and how brilliant he is, right? How we met was we helped him identify a great opportunity with a great company. You were there for 3 years, right? Had a really good experience. And from everything I remember, you were amazing to work with from a hiring perspective, which is why I'm excited to jump into this. But also being able to work with you and kind of help you through that process gave you a little bit of a sense of how we worked and how we operated too. So it was very cool that you get to see that 360 degree view. So I'm pumped about that. I want to start here about when you're hiring, core hiring philosophy. Do you have one? Does something come to mind?
Absolutely. I think that there's 10, 20 people with the same resume out. You find it. You're hiring for a role. You get a lot of resumes that are very similar in nature, right? And what I've learned over the years is I want to know what drives someone. I want to know their motivations because that's how I manage. If you talk to my teams, if you talk to my direct reports, they will tell you, Jose wants to understand what drives me, what motivates me, and then tries to set those goals in order for me to be engaged and for me to get it done, right? And I do, I put in the work. And that's why I read somewhere, I can't remember where, that a manager can only effectively manage seven people, seven direct reports. And I don't think that I've had more than that. And it for me, it was a great experience because I got to tailor my managing experience with each one of my direct reports, try to understand them, try to understand what drives them, and then try to understand on the company side, what are our objectives that this person can contribute to? And if you tie the both of them, that's when I think you have something special. That's when I think a department flourishes, and that's when I think that you go over the goals, you hit the goals, have an amazing, engaged department, and that you can really knock it out of the ballpark.
Okay, I just came up with this. People, market, fit, right person, right time, right seat. That's how you build the most high-performing teams.
Oh, yeah.
See what I did?
Absolutely.
Rub yeah,
it
all together.
I got it. I got
equal
it.
Market fit. That's it. We're bringing, that's a new MSH term. We're bringing it out. All right, Jose, what about memorable interview experiences? If I asked you for one, good, bad, funny, memorable, bring something up to us. Tell us a little bit of a story.
With me as a candidate or me hiring?
I want the best one, but I'll take both. Whatever you got.
Look, me hiring, I got to say, I had the opportunity to interview with Apple a few years back. And we were supposed to talk for 30 minutes. This was something very high up on the Apple hiring team. And we spent 90 minutes talking. And it was precisely that. They were asking me, what drives you? What motivates you? How do you get up every day and really think about, hey, this is a good day, right? Like, I love what I did today. And I told them about where I came from, what I've done, what I want to do, and what would motivate me about working at Apple. And again, it ended up being a 90-minute conversation with somebody who had worked with Steve Jobs early on in Apple. And it was just very engaging. Didn't get the job, that they went with somebody else. But I think it, in my mind, this person was really trying to understand not only if I would be a good fit, but if I'd be motivated to be in Apple and to do what they wanted me to do.
See, I find that really fascinating because you didn't get the job there. But that doesn't
matter. I did not.
You had a great experience. You remember that. I bet you if another opportunity came up down the road for you to reconsider, that opportunity, that experience would come back into your mind on why or why not you may not do that. And I even bet subconsciously, you're maybe a little bit more akin to like Apple products because of that experience too. And so one of my main tenets here is that one of the most underrated forms of marketing for a company, particularly one of that size, when you're touching so many potential people, is that idea of a candidate experience. Because if you have a bad experience interviewing with a company, you're probably not going to take a job there. You probably would tell a friend, I don't know if I'd go there. And you may or may not even use their products and services again. And I don't think we think about it that way.
You're selling the company as much as you are interviewing. So if you don't do a good job of interviewing, meaning you don't read up on the candidate, you don't sit down and really have a conversation with the candidate and really try to understand what's behind the 2-page resume, then the candidate is not going to be engaged. And you're absolutely right. I've interviewed with Apple for 2 positions, have not gotten either of them, but still, I consider them to be a world-class organization. And I consider them to be, if their hiring practices are as good as their products, that absolutely, Apple products are. And I'm not an Apple fanboy. I'm talking from a PC and I use both platforms equally. But the thing is, as a company, I have the utmost respect for Apple because of the experience that I've had with them as a candidate.
I love it. Thank you for sharing. And I hope many people just took down that note because it's really important. What about a favorite question you like to ask? Is there a question that you like to use in interviews that you think drives a special, unique insight?
I try to use open-ended questions. I try not to do any yes or no answers. What drives you? What motivates you? And just leave the candidate to kind of tell that story, right? One of the best, you asked me about best interviews. One of the best interviews that I have, and it's somebody who I still talk to today, back from my team in Millicom, I had the situation where I was pressed for time and I had to hire somebody, right? And I had one candidate, which I'd worked with before, highly professional candidate, awesome candidate. And I had this other candidate that was brought to my desk, probably somebody from your team. And this one was awesome, amazing. This one spends 15 minutes telling me about their experience, what's on the resume and everything. Spends the other 45 talking about what motivates them, what drives them, why they would be good at this job. And knocked it out of the park. It's one of the best hires that I've ever had.
The copy just writes itself. I appreciate that. That's awesome. I love that story. Let me ask you this way, because I love asking the questions back to the people. So let's ask you this, Jose. What motivates you? What drives you, especially as you find yourself in this new realm of your career?
Well, number one is I think that I'm very motivated to provide for my family, number one. I have 2 daughters. I have a wife. And you know what? I'm very motivated to provide for them, right? That's my number one motivation in the world, is my family. Number two, from a professional standpoint, I always am very curious and want to innovate, right? So speaking from a product management perspective, products have different stages, right? early on, there's a bunch of innovation that needs to happen to get it off the ground, to make sure that product has product market fit, to make sure that it's working well. Then it kind of stabilizes and then it dies, right? That's the way it goes for all of them. I had been in Yahoo, and very early on in my career, I was here most of the time, right? In that first half. And in the latter stages, I was trying to optimize in trying to keep products alive or shutting down products. And I think these new opportunities that I'm talking to you about is a lot of this. It's a lot of, hey, what if we do this? What if we innovate? What if we take this in a different direction? What if we take tools from one of the partners, right? And another one of the partners and put them together in a way that the market hadn't seen before. So I think that's what keeps me motivated, is just keep on innovating, keep on iterating and improving products, which is something that in my last experiences wasn't there as much, right? And that right now, I just feel amazing because of that, right? Because it's up to me to drive that middle of the field, as back to our football analogy. And it's up to me to see that and change the industry where we're going into, if that's even possible. But at least I'm bringing everything that I have to the table, putting all the cards down and saying, hey, I want to do this, right? And I want to do this right and for the right reasons.
Really good stuff. I appreciate that answer. It's a lot of great insight to you and how you're wired. What about something that frustrates you about current hiring process? Because it hasn't changed for many, many years. It could be on the candidate side. It could be on the manager side. But what's maybe just something that, if you could change it with the snap of a finger, or it's just a frustrating component for you when you look at traditional hiring standards?
Look, I think that something that frustrated me, not just with LPL, but prior to that, I think that number one, the pool of candidates sometimes isn't great. And that's something that for either the reason that it didn't get out to the right candidates, that it didn't get out to the right people. And sometimes, and I hate to say this, you have to settle for that pool, right? Either internal, external. So I think that one of those is ripe for disruption. Getting the right, again, we're going back to product market fit, but getting the right position to the right person at the right time is something that is very critical in doing a good hire. Because if the company has any kind of policies about giving internal preference or that sort of thing, I think that it limits the pool of candidates that you can get access to and the pool of experience that you can get access to. That's another one of my frustrations, is you got to hire this, right? You got to hire somebody who has these kind of years in financial management, these kind of years and this kind of years of that. One of my best hires at LPL was somebody who was not a manager previously and, yes, came from a financial background, but didn't have all the qualifications to be a senior manager on my team. But I made that decision. I hired that person, and she was just amazing, right? The drive from that professional compensated and more for all the different certifications that she didn't have, because she wanted to grow. She wanted to grow the team. She wanted to manage people. It's very different getting somebody who has that drive and has that passion for work than getting somebody who checks all the boxes and just shows up to work. And that's, again, why I think that your hiring practices, your hiring policies have to be open enough to allow you to make a good decision as a manager and have to help you make those decisions. Not the other way around, not limit your pool, not limit the decisions that you make based on company policies.
Good call. Let me ask you this last hiring question. So we all get it wrong. And you mentioned a little bit earlier, moving too quickly sometimes, or limited candidate pool and selecting, having a false choice, so to speak. When you do get it wrong, when you look back, is it one of those two, or is it something else that you point to as a theme that, you know, as over time you've maybe matured and got better at, or you're still working on?
No, listen, the times that I got it wrong early in my career, I went by brands, right? I said, hey, this person comes from this company, went to this school, did this. Wow, how can you go wrong? Person comes in, messes up royally, and it's your fault, right? Because you didn't get to the bottom of that person's qualifications, that person's motivations, that person's whole reason for being in that company. You got it wrong. And listen, it wasn't pressed for time. No way. It wasn't a small pool of candidates. Nope. I had my pick of the litter. It was because I didn't drive down deep enough into that person and understood what that person was about. If I went back and to Jose at that point and said, hey, you know what? Brands have a certain importance, yes, but they are not the most important thing about a candidate.
I totally agree with you. I've had customers that have made it a point to only look at the highest pedigree and brand. Something I learned pretty long ago was some of the dumbest people I know graduated from Yale and Harvard, and some of the most industrious and most successful and accomplished people didn't get a college degree or went to FIU and worked two jobs, or every situation is different. And we always are looking for these shortcuts and these heuristics. But I find that the more you rely on where somebody's been as an indicator of where they're going, and more importantly, that fit within your organization, the more likely you're going to continue to have bad hires that you have to unwind. So I think it's a really good lesson that you bring up here. Okay, I want to talk a little bit more day in the life right now. So let's talk about it. You left LPL. You're co-founding two different companies. For whatever reason, most people say that starting a company is chewing glass and staring into the abyss. You're doing it twice, double time over. Tell me a little bit about Built by Prime and TechWisp AI.
So let's start by Built by Prime. The construction industry is something that, by association, because of the time that I spent in a factory in operations, is something that I always had interest in. Right now, I always wanted to see just how much disruption could you make in that industry. And I think that with Built by Prime, I'm trying to take, and my partners are trying to take, the technology that we've learned from other places, the processes and management practices that we've had in our experience, and try to disrupt an industry that is just ripe for disruption. And I can tell you, after being at this for 5 months now, like, I think there's a good chance that we end up disrupting the industry just because of, it's not a natural fit. Technology, AI, machine learning, and all these different things with construction, just, it doesn't sound like proper fit, but that's exactly what we're trying to do. It's taking all of those learnings, all of those different technologies, and applying it to construction services.
Yeah, so as somebody who has had some remodeling done and worked with a lot of people who have had issues in the construction space, here's how you disrupt the construction industry. You just show up on time, get things done under budget on your timeline. That is going to be a multi-billion dollar organization.
There you go. There you go. It's easy as that, right?
Easy as that. All right. What about TechWisp AI?
So TechWisp, this is the learnings that a few colleagues and I got from our time at LPL, is that sometimes as a small business owner, from the tech stack perspective, meaning the technology that you need to run your business, you don't know what you don't know. And it's very hard for someone who has been in the financial industry just there to actually know the difference between, you know, what tech do I need and what's fluff, right? Or what kind of things I need to run my business efficiently. And maybe I'm double dipping into something, right? Maybe my CRM isn't compatible with the things that I use on a day-to-day, right? And maybe I'm overpaying or underpaying for something that I should. So taking all that learning into consideration, I got together with some other folks from that industry and putting together an AI-powered optimization tool for a small business tech stack.
So if people want to find out about these companies, are there websites you can point them to or something we can include in the show notes?
TechWisp.ai, it's up. We're running a pilot right now, and I'm hoping we can launch sometime in Q3.
I love that, man. All right, what about maybe a great book you read recently or content you've consumed that you want to share with our listeners?
So I don't think that I brought this up, but my master's degree, I studied at MIT, and one of my friends from MIT came up with an amazing book about entrepreneurship and the entrepreneur's journey. And that's the one that I'm reading right now and that I would highly recommend. It's called Entrepreneurial Confessions by Elliot Lung. And my friend went out into the world, talked to different entrepreneurs, different industries, and just documented the stories. How did they come up with the idea? What was their hardship that prompted them to do this nonprofit? How did they go from a transformation from this industry into another industry? It's really well written, really well detailed, and it gives you maybe 25 different stories from entrepreneurs and how they went about coming up with their business idea or making their business flourish. And I think it's just a great read. I'm about to finish it. And again, kudos to Elliot Lung, my good friend, for writing this book.
I love that. We'll include that in the show notes as well. I want to ask you a couple of speed round questions before we get to the last question about some advice you'd give your younger self. So let's start here. What is your favorite product that you've recently found and used? Anything that you'd recommend for people out there?
Wow, that's a good one. I think that Superhuman one is really interesting, right? Really interesting way. If you're used to Outlook, right? If you're used to just using Outlook for your emails, I think that is an eye-opener for you in how to organize your thoughts, write emails, organize your day-to-day. I think that's for anybody looking to, who is overwhelmed by their emails and wants to help them organize the way that they go about doing that, I'd look into that. That's a really great product to try out.
Okay. Ooh, I like that. All right. Which of these famous entrepreneurs and CEOs would you most like to run product for? Jeff Bezos, Elon Musk, Mark Zuckerberg.
I think I'd go with Jeff.
Okay. Why?
I've had a lot of friends who work at Amazon and who worked early on in Amazon. And I think that out of the three, I think that would be the most organized way of innovating and most organized way of running a business out of those three. I think that's Amazon. That's Jeff.
Yeah, right? I read Working Backwards a while ago, which is a really good book about all the different leadership principles at Amazon, the PRFAQ, the way that they incent right people from a compensation perspective, like just kind of gives you like a little bit of the brainchild and backbone behind it. And Jeff just did some fantastic things. Miami resident, Jeff Bezos, who I think went
to
Seattle. Didn't open up Amazon here in good old Miami, huh?
I think they're coming. I think they're coming.
All right. You love to hear. Last question, yeah. Jose. If you had some advice to give your 20-year-old self that you didn't know then, but that you know now, what would it be?
Any kind of advice, work-wise, hiring-wise, any.
Just the thing that 20-year-old Jose needs to hear.
Enjoy yourself.
Explain.
Enjoy yourself. There comes a time when you're working your butt off, and you have to, right? You have to pay your dues. You have to do things that you pull in an all-nighter, and you pull in as many late nights as you can to build yourself up and to learn about the business and do all these different things. You can't forget about enjoying yourself, right? Because there comes a time when if you don't do that and you don't celebrate your wins and you don't live life a little, it becomes very hard to find your passion and find your motivation if you don't do that. So I think that Jose at early 20s, mid 20s, did not enjoy life as much as Jose now does. And I think that's a thing that I should have done a long time ago.
Appreciate that. Jose, I really want to thank you for coming on. It's been an amazing conversation. I'm looking forward to continuing the conversation. Thanks again.
My pleasure. It's great to see you again.
All right, bud.